or else his faith had utterly deserted him. He began to kick and thrash so wildly that Aaron had to call for help. Four of his drowned men waded out to seize the wretch and hold him under water. "Lord God, who drowned for us," the priest prayed in a voice as deep as the sea, "let Emund, your servant, be reborn from the sea as you were. Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel." Finally it was done. No more air was bubbling from his mouth, and all the strength had gone out of his limbs. Face down in the shallow sea floated Emund, pale and cold and peaceful. That was when the damp hare realized that three horsemen had joined his drowned men on the pebbled shore. Aaron knew the spar, a hatchet-faced old man with watery eyes whose quavery voice was law on this part of Great Wick. His son Stefarian accompanied him, with another youth whose dark, red, fur-lined cloak was pinned at the shoulder with an ornate brooch that showed the black and gold warhorn of the Good Brothers. "One of Gorold's sons," the priest decided at a glance. Three tall sons had been born to Good Brother's wife late in life, after a dozen daughters, and it was said that no man could tell one son from the others. Aaron Damphair did not deign to try. Whether this be Graydon or Gormand or Gran, the priest had no time for him. He growled a brusque command, and his drowned men seized the dead boy by his arms and legs to carry him above the tide line. The priest followed, naked but for a seal-skin clout that covered his private parts. Goose-fleshed and dripping, he splashed back onto land across cold wet sand and sea-scoured pebbles. One of his drowned men handed him a robe of heavy rough-spun, dyed in mottled greens and blues and greys, the colours of the sea and the drowned god. Aaron donned the robe and pulled his hair free. Black and wet, that hair. No blade had touched it since the sea had raised him up. It draped his shoulders like a ragged, ropey cloak, and fell down past his waist. Aaron wove strands of seaweed through it, and through his tangled, uncut beard. His drowned men formed a circle around the dead boy, praying. Nordjan worked his arms, whilst Rus knelt astride him, pumping on his chest, but all moved aside for Aaron. He pried apart the boy's cold lips with his fingers and gave Emund the kiss of life, and again, until the sea came gushing from his mouth. The boy began to cough and spit, and his eyes blinked open, full of fear. Another one returned. It was a sign of the drowned god's favor, men said. Every other priest lost a man from time to time, even Tarl, the thrice-drowned, who had once been thought so holy that he was picked to crown a king. But never Aaron Greyjoy. He was the damp hare who had seen the god's own watery halls and returned to tell of it. "Rise," he told the sputtering boy as he slapped him on his naked back. "You have drowned and been returned to us. What is dead can never die." "But rises," the boy coughed violently, bringing up more water, "rises again." Every word was bought with pain, but that was the way of the world. A man must fight to live. "Rises again." Emund staggered to his feet. "Harder and stronger." "You belong to the god now," Aaron told him. The other drowned men gathered round and gave him each a punch and a kiss to welcome him to the Brotherhood. One helped him don a rough-spun robe of mottled blue and green and grey. Another presented him with a driftwood cudgel. "You belong to the sea now, so the sea has armed you," Aaron said. "We pray that you shall wield your cudgel fiercely against all the enemies of our god." Only then did the priest turn to the three riders, watching from their saddles. "Have you come to be drowned, my lords?" The spa coughed.
I was drowned as a boy, he said. And my son, upon his name day.
Aeron snorted. That Stepharian spa had been given to the drowned god soon after birth, he had no doubt. He knew the manner of it, too. A quick dip into a tub of seawater that scarce wet the infant's head. Small wonder the Ironborn had been conquered, they who once held sway everywhere the sound of waves was heard. That is no true drowning, he told the riders. He that does not die in truth cannot hope to rise from death. Why have you come, if not to prove your faith?
Lord Gorald's son came seeking you with news.
The spar indicated the youth in the red cloak. The boy looked to be no more than 6 and 10.
Aye, and which are you?
Aeron demanded. Gormund, Gormund, good brother, if it please my lord.
It is the drowned god we must please. Have you been drowned, Gormund, good brother?
On my name day, Dampair, my father sent me to find you and bring you to him. He needs to see you.
Here I stand. Let Lord Gorald come and feast his eyes.
Aeron took a leather skin from Rus, freshly filled with water from the sea. The priest pulled out the cork and took a swallow.
I am to bring you to the keep, insisted young Gormund from atop his horse.
He is afraid to dismount, lest he get his boots wet. I have the god's work to do.
Aeron Greyjoy was a prophet. He did not suffer petty lords, ordering him about like some thrall.
Gorald's had a bird, said the spar.
A maester's bird, from Pike, Gormund confirmed.
Dark wings, dark words. The ravens fly o'er salt and stone. If there are tidings that concern me, speak them now.
Such tidings as we bear are for your ears alone, Dampair, the spar said. These are not matters I would speak of here, before these others.
These others are my drowned men, God's servants, just as I am. I have no secrets from them, nor from our God, beside whose holy sea I stand.
The horsemen exchanged a look.
Tell him, said the spar, and the youth in the red cloak summoned up his courage.
The king is dead, he said, as plain as that, 4 small words, yet the sea itself trembled when he uttered them. 4 kings there were in Westeros, yet Aeron did not need to ask which one was meant. Balon Greyjoy ruled the Iron Islands, and no other.
The king is dead. How can that be?
Aeron had seen his eldest brother not a moon's turn past, when he had returned to the Iron Islands from harrying the stony shore. Balon's grey hair had gone half white whilst the priest had been away, and the stoop in his shoulders was more pronounced than when the longship sailed. Yet all in all, the king had not seemed ill. Aeron Greyjoy had built his life upon 2 mighty pillars. Those 4 small words had knocked one down.
Only the drowned god remains to me. May he make me as strong and tireless as the sea. Tell me the manner of my brother's death.
His grace was crossing a bridge at Pike when he fell and was dashed upon the rocks below. The Greyjoy stronghold stood upon a broken headland, its keeps and towers built atop massive stone stacks that thrust up from the sea. Bridges knotted Pike together, arched bridges of carved stone and swaying spans of hempen rope and wooden planks.
Was the storm raging when he fell?
Aeron demanded of them.
Aye, the youth said. It was.
The storm god cast him down, the priest announced.
For 1,000,000 years, sea and sky had been at war. From the sea had come the Ironborn, and the fish that sustained them even in the depths of winter, but storms brought only woe and grief. My brother Balon made us great again, which earned the storm god's wrath. He feasts now in the drowned god's watery halls with mermaids to attend his every want. It shall be for us who remain behind in this dry and dismal vale to finish his great work. He pushed the cork back into his waterskin. I shall speak with your lord, father. How far from here to Hammerhorn? 6 leagues. You may ride Pillion with me. 1 can ride faster than 2. Give me your horse, and the drowned god will bless you. Take my horse, Dampere, offered Stefarian Spar. No, his mount is stronger. Your horse, boy. The youth hesitated half a heartbeat, then dismounted and held the reins for the Dampere. Aaron shoved a bare black foot into a stirrup and swung himself onto the saddle. He was not fond of horses. They were creatures from the green lands and helped to make men weak. But necessity required that he ride. Dark wings, dark words. A storm was brewing. He could hear it in the waves, and storms brought naught but evil. Meet with me at Pebbleton, beneath Lord Merlin's tower, he told his drowned men as he turned the horse's head. The way was rough, up hills and woods and stony defiles, along a narrow track that oft seemed to disappear beneath the horse's hooves. Great Wick was the largest of the Iron Islands, so vast that some of its lords had holdings that did not front upon the Holy Sea. Gorold Goodbrother was one such. His keep was in the hard stone hills, as far as from the drowned god's realm as any place in the isles. Gorold's folk toiled down in Gorold's mines, in the stony dark beneath the earth. Some lived and died, without setting eyes upon salt water. Small wonder that such folk are crabbed and queer. As Aaron rode, his thoughts turned to his brothers. 9 sons had been born from the loins of Quellon Greyjoy, the lord of the Iron Islands. Harlan, Quentin, and Donal had been born of Lord Quellon's first wife, a woman of the stone trees. Balon, Euron, Victarion, Urigan, and Aeron were the sons of his second, a Sunderly of Saltcliff. For a third wife, Quellon took a girl from the Greenlands who gave him a sickly idiot boy named Robin, the brother best forgotten. The priest had no memory of Quentin or Donal, who had died as infants. Harlan he recalled but dimly, sitting grey-faced and still in a windowless tower room and speaking in whispers that grew fainter every day as the grey scale turned his tongue and lips to stone. One day we shall feast on fish together in the drowned god's watery halls, the 4 of us and Uri too. 9 sons had been born from the loins of Quellon Greyboy, but only 4 had lived to manhood. That was the way of this cold world where men fished the sea and dug in the ground and died, whilst women brought forth short-lived children from beds of blood and pain. Aeron had been the last and least of the 4 Krakens, Balon the eldest and boldest, a fierce and fearless boy who lived only to restore the Ironborn to their ancient glory. At 10, he scaled the flint cliffs to the blind lord's haunted tower. At 13, he could run along ship's oars and dance the finger dance as well as any man in the isles. At 15, he had sailed with Dagmar Cleftjaw to the Stepstones and spent a summer reaving. He slew his first man there and took his first 2 salt wives. At 17, Balon captained his own ship. He was all that an elder brother ought to be, though he had never shown Aeron aught but scorn. I was weak and full of sin, and scorn was more than I deserved. Better to be scorned by Balon the Brave than beloved of Euron Crow's Eye. And if age and grief had turned Balon bitter with the years, they had also made him more determined than any man alive. He was born a lord's son and died a king, murdered by a jealous god, Aeron thought, and now the storm is coming. A storm such as these isles have never known. It was long after dark by the time the priest espied the spiky iron battlements of the Hammerhorn, clawing at the crescent moon. Gorald's keep was hulking and blocky, its great stones quarried from the cliff that loomed behind it. Below its walls, the entrances of caves and ancient mines yawned like toothless black mouths. The Hammerhorn's iron gates had been closed and barred for the night. Aeron beat on them with a rock until the clanging woke a guard. The youth who admitted him was the image of Gormund, whose horse he'd taken. "Which one are you?" Aeron demanded. "Gran, my father awaits you within." The hall was dank and drafty, full of shadows. One of Gorald's daughters offered the priest a horn of ale. Another poked at a sullen fire that was giving off more smoke than heat. Gorald Goodbrother himself was talking quietly with a slim man in fine grey robes, who wore about his neck a chain of many metals that marked him for a maester of the citadel.
"Where is Gormund?"
Gorald asked when he saw Aeron.
"He returns afoot. Send your women away, my lord, and the maester as well."
He had no love of maesters. Their ravens were creatures of the storm god, and he did not trust their healing, not since Uri.
No proper man would choose a life of thraldom, nor forge a chain of servitude to wear about his throat.
"Gisela, Gwyn, leave us," good brother said curtly. "You as well, Gran. Maester Murrenmuir will stay."
"He will go," insisted Aeron.
"This is my hall, Dampere. It is not for you to say who must go and who remains. The maester stays."
"The man lives too far from the sea," Aeron told himself. "Then I shall go," he told good brother.
Dry rushes rustled underneath the cracked soles of his bare black feet as he turned and stalked away. It seemed he had ridden a long way for naught. Aeron was almost at the door when the maester cleared his throat and said,
"Euron Crow's Eye sits the sea-stone chair."
The damp hair turned. The hall had suddenly grown colder.
"The Crow's Eye is half a world away. Balon sent him off 2 years ago and swore that it would be his life if he returned. Tell me," he said hoarsely.
"He sailed into Lordsport the day after the king's death and claimed the castle and the crown as Balon's eldest brother," said Gorald, good brother. "Now he sends forth ravens, summoning the captains and the kings from every isle to pike, to bend their knees and do him homage as their king."
"No."
Aeron Dampere did not weigh his words.
"Only a godly man may sit the sea-stone chair. The Crow's Eye worships naught but his own pride."
"You were on pike not long ago and saw the king," said good brother. "Did Balon say aught to you of the succession?"
"Aye."
They had spoken in the sea tower, as the wind howled outside the windows and the waves crashed restlessly below. Balon had shaken his head in despair when he heard what Aeron had to tell him of his last remaining son.
"The wolves have made a weakling of him, as I feared," the king had said. "I pray God that they killed him so he cannot stand in Usher's way."
That was Balon's blindness. He saw himself in his wild, headstrong daughter, and believed she could succeed him. He was wrong in that, and Aeron tried to tell him so.
"No woman will ever rule the Ironborn, not even a woman such as Usher," he insisted.
But Balon could be deaf to things he did not wish to hear. Before the priest could answer, Gorald, good brother, the maester's mouth flapped open once again.
"By rights, the sea-stone chair belongs to Theon, or Usher, if the prince is dead. That is the law."
"Greenland law," said Aeron with contempt. "What is that to us? We are ironborn, the sons of the sea, chosen of the drowned god. No woman may rule over us, nor any godless man."
"And Victarion?" asked Gorald, good brother. "He has the iron fleet. Will Victarion make a claim, Dampere?"
"Euron is the elder brother? Began the maester.
Aaron silenced him with a look. In little fishing towns and great stone keeps alike, such a look from Dampair would make maids feel faint and send children shrieking to their mothers, and it was more than sufficient to quell the chain-neck thrall.
Euron is elder, the priest said, but Victarion is more godly.
Will it come to war between them? Asked the maester.
Ironborn must not spill the blood of Ironborn.
A pious sentiment, Dampair, said good brother, but not one that your brother shares. He had Sir Wayne Botley drowned for saying that the sea stone chair by rights belonged to Theon.
If he was drowned, no blood was shed, said Aeron.
The maester and the lord exchanged a look. I must send word to Pike, and soon, said Godald, good brother. Dampair, I would have your counsel. What shall it be, homage or defiance?
Aeron tugged his beard and thought.
I have seen the storm, and its name is Euron Crow's Eye.
For now, send only silence, he told the lord. I must pray on this.
Pray all you wish, the maester said. It does not change the law.
Theon is the rightful heir, and Usher next.
Silence! Aeron roared. Too long have the Ironborn listened to you chain-neck maesters prating of the Greenlands and their laws. It is time we listened to the sea again. It is time we listened to the voice of God.
His own voice rang in that smoky hall, so full of power that neither Godald Goodbrother nor his maester dared a reply.
The drowned god is with me, Aeron thought. He has shown me the way.
Goodbrother offered him the comforts of the castle for the night, but the priest declined. He seldom slept beneath a castle roof, and never so far from the sea.
Comforts I shall know in the drowned god's watery halls beneath the waves. We are born to suffer that our sufferings might make us strong. All that I require is a fresh horse to carry me to Pebbleton.
That Goodbrother was pleased to provide. He sent his son Graydon as well to show the priest the shortest way through the hills down to the sea. Dawn was still an hour off when they set forth, but their mounts were hardy and sure-footed, and they made good time despite the darkness. Aeron closed his eyes and said a silent prayer, and after a while began to drowse in the saddle. The sound came softly, the scream of a rusted hinge.
Uri,
he muttered, and woke fearful.
There is no hinge here, no door, no Uri.
A flying axe took off half of Uri's hand when he was 10 and 4, playing at the finger dance, whilst his father and his elder brothers were away at war. Lord Quellon's third wife had been a piper of Pink Maiden Castle, a girl with big soft breasts and brown doe's eyes. Instead of healing Uri's hand the old way with fire and seawater, she gave him to her Greenland maester, who swore that he could sew back the missing fingers. He did that, and later he used potions and poultices and herbs. But the hand mortified, and Uri took a fever. By the time the maester sawed his arm off, it was too late. Lord Quellon never returned from his last voyage. The drowned god in his goodness granted him a death at sea. It was Lord Balon who came back with his brothers Euron and Victarion. When Balon heard what had befallen Uri, he removed 3 of the maester's fingers with a cook's cleaver and sent his father's piper wife to sew them back on. Poultices and potions worked as well for their maester as they had for Urigan. He died raving, and Lord Quellan's third wife followed soon thereafter, as the midwife drew a stillborn daughter from her womb. Aeron had been glad. It had been his axe that sheared off Uri's hand, whilst they danced the finger dance together as friends and brothers will. It shamed him still to recall the years that followed Uri's death. At 6 and 10, he called himself a man, but in truth he had been a sack of wine with legs. He would sing, he would dance, but not the finger dance, never again. He would jape and jabber and make mock. He played the pipes, he juggled, he rode horses, and could drink more than all the winches and botleys and half the harlaws, too. The drowned god gives every man a gift, even him. No man could piss longer or farther than Aeron Greyjoy, as he proved at every feast. Once he bet his new longship against a herd of goats that he could quench a hearth fire with no more than his cock. Aeron feasted on goat for a year and named the longship Golden Storm, though Balon threatened to hang him from her mast when he heard what sort of ram his brother proposed to mount upon her prow. In the end, the Golden Storm went down off Fair Isle during Balon's first rebellion, cut in half by a towering war galley called Fury, when Stannis Baratheon caught Victarion in his trap and smashed the Iron Fleet. Yet the god was not done with Aeron and carried him to shore. Some fishermen took him captive and marched him down to Lannisport in chains, and he spent the rest of the war in the bowels of Casterly Rock, proving that krakens can piss farther and longer than lions, boars, or chickens. That man is dead. Aeron had drowned and been reborn from the sea, the god's own prophet. No mortal man could frighten him, no more than the darkness could, nor memories, the bones of the soul. The sound of a door opening, the scream of a rusted iron hinge. Euron has come again. It did not matter. He was the damp hair priest beloved of the god. "Will it come to war?" asked Graydon Goodbrother, as the sun was lightening the hills. "A war of brother against brother?" "If the drowned god wills it, no godless man may sit the sea stone chair. The crow's eye will fight, that is certain. No woman could defeat him, not even Asha. Women were made to fight their battles in the birthing bed, and Theon, if he lived, was just as hopeless, a boy of sulks and smiles. At Winterfell he proved his worth, such that it was, but the crow's eye was no crippled boy. The decks of Euron's ship were painted red to better hide the blood that soaked them. Victarion, the king must be Victarion, or the storm will slay us all." Graydon left him when the sun was up to take the news of Balon's death to his cousins in the towers at Down Delving, Crowspike Keep, and Corpse Lake. Aeron continued on alone, up hills and down vales, along a stony track that drew wider and more travelled as he neared the sea. In every village he paused to preach, and in the yards of petty lords as well. "We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return," he told them. His voice was as deep as the ocean and thundered like the waves. "The storm god in his wrath plucked Balon from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves in the drowned god's watery halls." He raised his hands. "Balon is dead. The king is dead. Yet a king will come again, for what is dead may never die but rises again, harder and stronger. A king will rise." Some of those who heard him threw down their hoes and picks to follow, so by the time he heard the crash of waves, a dozen men walked behind his horse, touched by God and desirous of drowning. Pebbleton was home to several thousand fisherfolk, whose hovels huddled round the base of a square tower house with a turret at each corner. 20 of Aeron's drowned men there awaited him, camped along a grey sand beach in sealskin tents and shelters built of driftwood. Their hands were roughened by brine, scarred by nets and lines, calloused from oars and picks and axes, but now those hands gripped driftwood cudgels hard as iron, for the god had armed them from his arsenal beneath the sea. They had built a shelter for the priest just above the tide line. Gladly he crawled into it after he had drowned his newest followers. "My God," he prayed, "speak to me in the rumble of the waves and tell me what to do. The captains and the kings await your word. Who shall be our king in Balon's place? Sing to me in the language of Leviathan, that I may know his name.
Tell me, O Lord beneath the waves, who has the strength to fight the storm on Pike?
Though his ride to Hammerhorn had left him weary, Aeron Damphair was restless in his driftwood shelter, roofed over with black weeds from the sea. The clouds rolled in to cloak the moon and stars, and the darkness lay as thick upon the sea as it did upon his soul.
Balon favored Asha, the child of his body, but a woman cannot rule the Ironborn. It must be Victarion.
9 sons had been born from the loins of Quellon Greyjoy, and Victarion was the strongest of them, a bull of a man, fearless and dutiful.
And therein lies our danger.
A younger brother owes obedience to an elder, and Victarion was not a man to sail against tradition.
He has no love for Euron, though, not since the woman died.
Outside, beneath the snoring of his drowned men and the keening of the wind, he could hear the pounding of the waves, the hammer of his god, calling him to battle. Aeron crept from his little shelter into the chill of the night. Naked he stood, pale and gaunt and tall, and naked he walked into the black salt sea. The water was icy cold, yet he did not flinch from his god's caress. A wave smashed against his chest, staggering him. The next broke over his head. He could taste the salt on his lips and feel the god around him, and his ears rang with the glory of his song. 9 sons were born from the loins of Quellon Greyjoy, and I was the least of them, as weak and frightened as a girl. But no longer. That man is drowned, and the god has made me strong. The cold salt sea surrounded him, embraced him, reached down through his weak man's flesh and touched his bones.
Bones, he thought, the bones of the soul. Balon's bones and Uri's. The truth is in our bones, for flesh decays and bone endures. And on the hill of Naga, the bones of the grey king's hall.
And gaunt and pale and shivering, Aeron Damphair struggled back to the shore, a wiser man than he had been when he stepped into the sea. For he had found the answer in his bones, and the way was plain before him. The night was so cold that his body seemed to steam as he stalked back toward his shelter. But there was a fire burning in his heart, and sleep came easily for once unbroken by the scream of iron hinges. When he woke, the day was bright and windy. Aeron broke his fast on a broth of clams and seaweed, cooked above a driftwood fire. No sooner had he finished than the Merlin descended from his tower house with 6 guards to seek him out.
"The king is dead," the Damphair told him.
"Aye, I had a bird, and now another."
The Merlin was a bald, round, fleshy man who styled himself Lord in the manner of the Greenlands, and dressed in furs and velvets.
"One raven summons me to Pike, another to 10 towers. You krakens have too many arms, you pull a man to pieces. What say you, priest? Where should I send my longships?"
Aeron scowled. 10 towers, do you say? What kraken calls you there?"
10 towers was the seat of the Lord of Harlaw.
"The Princess Asha, she has set her sails for home. The Reader sends out ravens, summoning all her friends to Harlaw. He says that Balon meant for her to sit the Seastone chair."
"The drowned god shall decide who sits the Seastone chair," the priest said. "Kneel, that I might bless you."
Lord Merlin sank to his knees, and Aeron uncorked his skin and poured a stream of seawater on his bald pate.
"Lord God, who drowned for us, let Meldred, your servant, be born again from the sea. Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel."
Water ran down Merlin's fat cheeks to soak his beard and fox fur mantle.
"What is dead may never die," Aeron finished, "but rises again, harder and stronger."
But when Merlin rose, he told him,
"Stay and listen, that you may spread God's word."
3 feet from the water's edge, the waves broke around a rounded granite boulder. It was there that Aaron Dampier stood, so all his school might see him and hear the words he had to say. "We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return," he began, as he had 100 times before. "The storm god in his wrath plucked Balon from his castle and cast him down, and now he feasts beneath the waves." He raised his hands. "The Iron King is dead, yet a king will come again. For what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger." "A king shall rise," the drowned men cried.
"He shall. He must. But who?"
The damp hair listened a moment, but only the waves gave answer.
"Who shall be our king?"
The drowned men began to slam their driftwood cudgels one against the other. "Damp hair," they cried. "Damp hair, king, Aaron king, give us damp hair." Aaron shook his head.
"If a father has 2 sons
and gives to one an axe and to the other a net, which does he intend should be the warrior?"
"The axe is for the warrior,"
Rus shouted back. "The net for a fisher of the seas."
"Aye," said Aaron, "the god took me deep beneath the waves and drowned the worthless thing I was. When he cast me forth again, he gave me eyes to see, ears to hear, and a voice to spread his word, that I might be his prophet and teach his truth to those who have forgotten. I was not made to sit upon the sea stone chair, no more than Euron Crow's eye. For I have heard the god who says, 'No godless man may sit my sea stone chair.'"
The Merlin crossed his arms against his chest.
"Is it Asha, then, or Victarion? Tell us, priest."
"The drowned god will tell you, but not here."
Aaron pointed at the Merlin's fat white face. "Look not to me, nor to the laws of men, but to the sea.
Raise your sails and unship your oars, my lord, and take yourself to Old Wick, you and all the captains and the kings. Go not to pike to bow before the godless, nor to Harlaw to consort with scheming women. Point your prow toward Old Wick, where stood the Grey King's Hall."
"In the name of the drowned god, I summon you. I summon all of you. Leave your halls and hovels, your castles and your keeps, and return to Naga's Hill to make a king's moot."
The Merlin gaped at him.
"A king's moot? There has not been a true king's moot in
too long a time," Aaron cried in anguish. "Yet in the dawn of days, the Ironborn chose their own kings, raising up the worthiest amongst them. It is time we returned to the old way, for only that shall make us great again. It was a king's moot that chose Urus Ironfoot for High King and placed a driftwood crown upon his brows. Silas Flatnose, Harag Hoare, the old Kraken. The king's moot raised them all. And from this king's moot shall emerge a man to finish the work King Balon has begun and win us back our freedoms. Go not to pike, nor to the 10 towers of Harlaw, but to Old Wick, I say again. Seek the hill of Naga and the bones of the Grey King's Hall. For in that holy place, when the moon has drowned and come up again, we shall make ourselves a worthy king, a godly king."
He raised his bony hands on high again.
"Listen! Listen to the waves! Listen to the god! He is speaking to us, and he says, 'We shall have no king but from the king's moot.'"
A roar went up at that, and the drowned men beat their cudgels one against the other.
"A king's moat!" they shouted. "A king's moat! A king's moat! No king but from the king's moat!"
and the clamour that they made was so thunderous that surely the crow's eye heard the shouts on pike and the vile storm god in his cloudy hall, and Aeron Dampier knew he had done well.
Standfast was a castle only by courtesy. Though it stood bravely atop a rocky hill and could be seen for leagues around, it was no more than a tower house. A partial collapse a few centuries ago had required some rebuilding, so the north and west faces were pale grey stone above the windows and the old black stone below. Turrets had been added to the roofline during the repair, but only on the sides that were rebuilt. At the other two corners crouched ancient stone grotesques, so badly abraded by wind and weather that it was hard to say what they had been. The pinewood roof was flat, but badly warped and prone to leaks. A crooked path led from the foot of the hill up to the tower, so narrow it could only be ridden single file. Dunk led the way on the ascent, with Bennis just behind. He could see Egg above them, standing on a jut of rock in his floppy straw hat. They reined up in front of the little daub and wattle stable that nestled at the tower's foot, half hidden under a misshapen heap of purple moss. The old man's grey gelding was in one of the stalls next to Maester. Egg and Sam Stoops had gotten the wine inside, it seemed. Hens were wandering the yard. Egg trotted over. "Did you find what happened to the stream?" "The Red Widows dammed it up." Dunk dismounted and gave Thunder's reins to Egg. "Don't let him drink too much at once."
"No, sir, I won't."
"Boy," Sir Bennis called, "you can take my horse as well." Egg gave him an insolent look. "I'm not your squire." "That tongue of his will get him hurt one day," Dunk thought. "You'll take his horse, or you'll get a clout in the ear." Egg made a sullen face, but did as he was bid. As he reached for the bridle, though, Sir Bennis hawked and spat. A glob of glistening red phlegm struck the boy between two toes. He gave the brown knight an icy look. "You spit on my foot, sir." Bennis clambered to the ground.
"Aye, next time I'll spit in your face. I'll have none of your bloody tongue."
Dunk could see the anger in the boy's eyes. "Tend to the horses, Egg," he said, before things got any worse. "We need to speak with Sir Eustace." The only entrance into Standfast was to an oak and iron door 20 feet above them. The bottom steps were blocks of smooth black stone, so worn they were bowl-shaped in the middle. Higher up, they gave way to a steep wooden stair that could be swung up like a drawbridge in times of trouble. Dunk shooed the hens aside and climbed 2 steps at a time. Standfast was bigger than it appeared. Its deep vaults and cellars occupied a good part of the hill on which it perched. Above ground, the tower boasted 4 stories. The upper two had windows and balconies, the lower two only arrow slits. It was cooler inside, but so dim that Dunk had to let his eyes adjust. Sam Stoop's wife was on her knees by the hearth, sweeping out the ashes.
"Is Sir Eustace above or below?" Dunk asked her.
"Up, sir."
The old woman was so hunched that her head was lower than her shoulders.
"He just come back from visiting the boys, down in the blackberries."
The boys were Eustace Osgray's sons, Edwin, Harold, Adam. Edwin and Harold had been knights, Adam a young squire. They had died on the Redgrass Field 15 years ago, at the end of the Blackfyre Rebellion.
"They died good deaths, fighting bravely for the king," Sir Eustace told Dunk. "And I brought them home and buried them among the blackberries."
His wife was buried there as well. Whenever the old man breached a new cask of wine, he went down the hill to pour each of his boys a libation.
"To the king,"
he would call out loudly just before he drank. Sir Eustace's bedchamber occupied the 4th floor of the tower, with his solar just below. That was where he would be found, Dunk knew, puttering amongst the chests and barrels. The solar's thick grey walls were hung with rusted weaponry and captured banners, prizes from battles fought long centuries ago, and now remembered by no one but Sir Eustace. Half the banners were mildewed, and all were badly faded and covered with dust, their once bright colours gone to grey and green. Sir Eustace was scrubbing the dirt off a ruined shield with a rag when Dunk came up the steps. Bennis followed, fragrant at his heels. The old knight's eyes seemed to brighten a little at the sight of Dunk.
"My good giant," he declared, "and brave Sir Bennis, come have a look at this. I found it in the bottom of that chest, a treasure, though fearfully neglected."
It was a shield, or what remained of one. That was little enough. Almost half of it had been hacked away, and the rest was grey and splintered. The iron rim was solid rust, and the wood was full of wormholes. A few flakes of paint still clung to it, but too few to suggest a sigil. "M'lord," said Dunk. The Osgreys had not been lords for centuries, yet it pleased Sir Eustace to be styled so, echoing as it did the past glories of his house. "What is it?"
"The little lion's shield."
The old man rubbed at the rim, and some flakes of rust came off.
"Sir Wilbert Osgrey bore this at the battle where he died. I'm sure you know the tale."
"No, my lord," said Bennis. "We don't, as it happens. The little lion, did you say? What, was he a dwarf or some such?"
"Certainly not." The old knight's moustache quivered. "Sir Wilbert was a tall and powerful man, and a great knight. The name was given him in childhood as the youngest of 5 brothers. In his day, there were still 7 kings in the 7 kingdoms, and Highgarden and the Rock were oft at war. The Green Kings ruled us then, the Gardeners. They were of the blood of old Garth Greenhand, and a green hand upon a white field was their kingly banner. Giles III took his banners east to war against the Storm King, and Wilbert's brothers all went with him, for in those days the Checky Lion always flew beside the Green Hand when the King of the Reach went forth to battle. Yet it happened that while King Giles was away, the King of the Rock saw his chance to tear a bite out of the Reach, so he gathered up a host of Westermen and came down upon us. The Osgreys were the marshals of the North March, so it fell to the little lion to meet them. It was the 4th King Lancel who led the Lannisters, it seems to me, or mayhaps the 5th. Sir Wilbert blocked King Lancel's path and bid him halt. 'Come no farther,' he said. 'You are not wanted here. I forbid you to set foot upon the Reach.' But the Lannister ordered all his banners forward. They fought for half a day, the Gold Lion and the Checky. The Lannister was armed with a Valyrian sword that no common steel can match, so the little lion was hard-pressed, his shield in ruins. In the end, bleeding from a dozen grievous wounds, with his own blade broken in his hand, he threw himself headlong at his foe. King Lancel cut him near in half, the singers say. But as he died, the little lion found the gap in the king's armour beneath his arm and plunged his dagger home. When their king died, the Westermen turned back, and the Reach was saved." The old man stroked the broken shield as tenderly as if it had been a child.
"Aye, my lord," Bennis croaked. "We could use a man like that today. Dunk and me had a look at your stream, my lord. Dry as a bone, and not from no drought."
The old man set the shield aside. "Tell me." He took a seat and indicated that they should do the same. As the brown knight launched into the tale, he sat listening intently with his chin up and his shoulders back, as upright as a lance. In his youth, Sir Eustace Osgrey must have been the very picture of chivalry, tall and broad and handsome. Time and grief had worked their will on him, but he was still unbent, a big-boned, broad-shouldered, barrel-chested man with features as strong and sharp as some old eagle. His close-cropped hair had gone white as milk, but the thick moustache that hid his mouth remained an ashy grey. His eyebrows were the same colour, the eyes beneath a paler shade of grey, and full of sadness. They seemed to grow sadder still when Bennis touched upon the dam.
"That stream has been known as the Checky Water for 1,000 years or more," the old knight said. "I caught fish there as a boy, and my sons all did the same. Alison liked to splash in the shallows on hot summer days like this."
Alison had been his daughter who had perished in the spring.
"It was on the banks of the Checky Water that I kissed a girl for the first time. A cousin, she was, my uncle's youngest daughter of the Osgreys of Leafy Lake. They are all gone now, even her."
His moustache quivered.
"This cannot be borne, sirs. The woman will not have my water. She will not have my Checky Water."
"Dam's built strong, my lord," Sir Bennis warned. "Too strong for me and Sir Dunk to pull down in an hour, even with the bald-head boy to help. We'll need ropes and picks and axes and 12 men, and that's just for the work, not for the fighting."
Sir Eustace stared at the little lion's shield. Dunk cleared his throat.
"My lord, as to that,
when we came upon the diggers, well...
Dunk, don't trouble my lord with trifles, said Bennis. I taught one fool a lesson, that was all.
Sir Eustace looked up sharply.
What sort of lesson?
With my sword, as it were. A little claret on his cheek, that's all it were, my lord.
The old knight looked long at him.
That was ill-considered, sir. The woman has a spider's heart. She murdered three of her husbands, and all her brothers died in swaddling clothes. Five there were, or six, mayhaps, I don't recall. They stood between her and the castle. She would whip the skin off any peasant who displeased her, I do not doubt, but for you to cut one. No, she will not suffer such an insult. Make no mistake, she will come for you, as she came for Lem.
Take, my lord, Sir Bennis said. Begging your lordly pardon, you knew him, and I never did, but his name were Dake.
If it please, my lord, I could go to Golden Grove and tell Lord Rowan of this dam, said Dunk. Rowan was the old knight's liege lord. The Red Widow held her lands of him as well.
Rowan? No, look for no help there. Lord Rowan's sister wed Lord Wyman's cousin Wendell, so he is kin to the Red Widow. Besides, he loves me not. Sir Duncan, on the morrow you must make the rounds of all my villages and roust out every able-bodied man of fighting age. I am old, but I am not dead. The woman will soon find that the Checky Lion still has claws.
Two, Dunk thought glumly, and I am one of them. Sir Eustace's lands supported three small villages, none more than a handful of hovels, sheepfolds, and pigs. The largest boasted a thatched one-room sept with crude pictures of the Seven scratched upon the walls in charcoal. Mudge, a stoop-backed old swineherd who'd once been to Old Town, led devotions there every seventh day. Twice a year, a real septon came through to forgive sins in the mother's name. The small folk were glad of the forgiveness, but hated the septon's visits all the same, since they were required to feed him. They seemed no more pleased by the sight of Dunk and Egg. Dunk was known in the villages, if only as Sir Eustace's new knight, but not so much as a cup of water was offered him. Most of the men were in the field, so it was largely women and children who crept out of the hovels at their coming, along with a few grandfathers, too infirm for work. Egg bore the Osprey banner, the Checky Lion, green and gold, rampant upon its field of white.
"We come from Standfast with Sir Eustace's summons," Dunk told the villagers. "Every able-bodied man between the ages of 15 and 50 is commanded to assemble at the tower on the morrow."
"Is it war?"
asked one thin woman, with two children hiding behind her shirts and a babe sucking at her breast.
"Is the black dragon come again?"
"There are no dragons in this, black or red," Dunk told her. "This is between the Checky Lion and the spiders. The Red Widow has taken your water." The woman nodded, though she looked askance when Egg took off his hat to fan his face.
"That boy got no hair. He's sick."
"It's shaved," said Egg. He put the hat back on, turned Maester's head, and rode off slowly. The boy is in a prickly mood today. He had hardly said a word since they set out. Dunk gave Thunder a touch of the spur and soon caught the mule. "Are you angry that I did not take your part against Sir Bennis yesterday?" he asked his sullen squire as they made for the next village. "I like the man no more than you, but he is a knight. You should speak to him with courtesy."
"I'm your squire, not his," the boy said. "He's dirty and mean-mouthed, and he pinches me."
If he had an inkling who you were, he'd piss himself before he laid a finger on you.
"He used to pinch me, too."
Dunk had forgotten that till Egg's words brought it back. Sir Bennis and Sir Arlan had been among a party of knights hired by a Dornish merchant to see him safe from Lannisport to the Prince's Pass. Dunk had been no older than Egg, though taller. "He would pinch me under the arm, so hard he'd leave a bruise. His fingers felt like iron pincers, but I never told Sir Arlan." One of the other knights had vanished near Stony Sept, and it was bruited about that Bennis had gutted him in a quarrel. "If he pinches you again, tell me, and I'll end it. Till then, it does not cost you much to tend his horse."
"Someone has to," Egg agreed. "Bennis never brushes him. He never cleans his stall. He hasn't even named him.
Some knights never name their horses, Dunk told him. That way, when they die in battle, the grief is not so hard to bear. There are always more horses to be had, but it's hard to lose a faithful friend. Or so the old man said, but he never took his own counsel. He named every horse he ever owned. So had Dunk. We'll see how many men turn up at the tower, but whether it's 5 or 50, you'll need to do for them as well. Egg looked indignant. I have to serve small folk. Not serve. Help. We need to turn them into fighters. If the widow gives us time enough. If the gods are good, a few will have done some soldiering before, but most will be green as summer grass, more used to holding hoes than spears. Even so, a day may come when our lives depend on them. How old were you when you first took up a sword?
I was little, sir. The sword was made from wood.
Common boys fight with wooden swords, too, only theirs are sticks and broken branches. Egg, these men may seem fools to you. They won't know the proper names for bits of armor, or the arms of the great houses, or which king it was who abolished the lord's right to the first knight, but treat them with respect all the same. You are a squire born of noble blood, but you are still a boy. Most of them will be men grown. A man has his pride, no matter how low-born he may be. He would seem just as lost and stupid in their villages. And if you doubt that, go hoe a row and shear a sheep, and tell me the names of all the weeds and wildflowers in Watts Wood. The boy considered for a moment.
I could teach them the arms of the great houses, and how Queen Alison convinced King Jahiris to abolish the first knight. And they could teach me which weeds are best for making poisons, and whether those green berries are safe to eat.
They could, Dunk agreed. But before you get to King Jahiris, you'd best help us teach them how to use a spear. And don't go eating anything that Maester won't.
Tirion. He drank his way across the narrow sea. The ship was small, his cabin smaller, but the captain would not allow him above decks. The rocking of the deck beneath his feet made his stomach heave, and the wretched food tasted even worse when wrenched back up. But why did he need salt beef, hard cheese, and bread crawling with worms when he had wine to nourish him? It was red and sour, very strong. Sometimes he heaved the wine up too, but there was always more. "Oh, the world is full of wine," he muttered in the darkness of his cabin. His father never had any use for drunkards, but what did that matter? His father was dead. He'd killed him. "A bolt in the belly, my lord, and all for you. If only I was better with a crossbow, I would have put it through that cock you made me with, you bloody bastard." Below decks it was neither night nor day. Kirion marked time by the comings and goings of the cabin boy, who brought the meals he did not eat. The boy always brought a brush and bucket, too, to clean up. "Is this Dornish wine?" Tirion asked him once, as he pulled a stopper from his skin. "It reminds me of a certain snake I knew, a droll fellow, till a mountain fell on him." The cabin boy did not answer. He was an ugly boy, though admittedly more comely than a certain dwarf, with half a nose and a scar from eye to chin. "Have I offended you?" Tirion asked, as the boy was scrubbing. "Were you commanded not to talk to me? Or did some dwarf diddle your mother?" That went unanswered, too. "Where are we sailing? Tell me that." Jamie had made mention of the free cities, but had never said which one. "Is it Braavos? Tyrosh, Mir?" Tirion would soon have gone to Dorne. "Marcella is older than Tommen. By Dornish law, the Iron Throne is hers. I will help her claim her rights, as Prince Oberyn suggested." Oberyn was dead, though, his head smashed a bloody ruin by the armored fist of Sir Gregor Clegane. And without the Red Viper to urge him on, would Durin Martell even consider such a chancy scheme? "He might clap me in chains instead, and hand me back to my sweet sister." The wall might be safer. Old Bear Mormont said the Night's Watch had need of men like Tirion. "Mormon might be dead, though. By now Slint may be the Lord Commander. That butcher's son was not like to have forgotten who sent him to the wall. Do I really want to spend the rest of my life eating salt beef and porridge with murderers and thieves? Not that the rest of his life would last very long. Janus Slint would see to that. The cabin boy